Now on Facebook Live and RadioBuzz.com, this is No Limit People with Dr. Will Horton.
Hello, everyone. Do you dream of a better life? That better life might be a better physical body, a better relationship, more income, or even spiritual growth. And I want you to know it's not your fault. You haven't achieved it yet because you don't know what you don't know. And so you know that there are people that profit from your pain. And I've been there, and I was lucky enough to learn some techniques and tips to live a new life. So join me in learning how to be a no-limit person. I'm Dr. Will Horton, licensed psychologist, leading expert in hypnosis and NLP, and this is No Limit People, NLP for the real world. The format's simple. I have guests and shows that help you break those limits that's holding you back. And at every show, at the end or during the show, we'll do a mind hack to help you get some more control and break some of those limits. So welcome. Today I get to interview someone I've known in a way for quite a while, and I've been following him lately. He's got a lot of good things to say. He's a friend of another dear friend, as I like to say, you know, as I do my anchoring, my dear friend, Tony Robbins. So I'd like you to welcome Mr. Stephen. He'll tell us a little bit about himself and how he got into this world of self-development, self-growth, and what he's doing now that's so exciting.
How's it going, Will?
Good.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. For me, it's a little bit different, guys. For me, Dr. Horton actually was the guy who taught me NLP, was the guy that introduced me to hypnotherapy, the guy that really started to take me down into the mechanics of this change work in a way that was functional and by design. So to be on this, getting interviewed by you is kind of like a wow. It's like, oh, cool. So thank you for bringing me on.
Oh, you're welcome. So what got you into this self-development track, if you want to call it that, self-growth, personal growth?
Well, for me, it was out of necessity. You know, I remember one of my earliest memories of childhood. I mean, I was 7 years old and, you know, being woken up and seeing, you know, the stereo, the what looked like lights all around me. The cops had surrounded the house and my father and mother had once again been, you know, in their alcoholic fits, and my dad had come around the corner, tried to shoot my mom with the double barrel shotgun, and my mom got pissed off and broke his leg. And so that's the world I grew up in. And I grew up in a world where there wasn't a lot of magic. There wasn't a lot of, you know, the love was there, but it was there was a disconnect between the ability for them to actually experience it in a way that was holistic and healthy. And so I used to go on long walks with God, talk to God and please make me normal. And then I figured out, well, I needed to get moving on, if you're going to be the change, if you want the change, you got to be the change kind of thing. And I took a workshop where they looked at the shadow and they really started looking at some of the Jungian concepts. And that was, April 14th, 2000. And I developed a mission. And from that mission, I developed some rituals. And one of those rituals is I have a trigger, an anchor. I learned that through NLP. Real excellent teacher telling us, but this is an anchor. And what it reminds me is I get up every morning and I grab this and I ask myself, do I want to live mission today? Do I choose today to live in a way that will be of service, that will impact the world? And then at the end of the night, I lay back on my bed and I go, okay, what did I do today to live mission? And that has been probably, Doc, that's probably been the single most defining ritual that I can think of, because it's led to everything else. It led me to you. It led me to Tony. It led me to, you know, Gene McNaughton, Jason Cisneros, on and on and on and on. It led me to all these geniuses and allowed me the ability to study what works and what doesn't work in personal development.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Yeah.
And I was thinking today we'll talk a little bit about what you just said about rituals, how to develop a ritual for success, and also talk about one of my sayings that I like besides, you know, you don't know what you don't know. You have to learn these things. Right. But one is you don't always rise to the level of your expectations, but you will always fall to the level of your peers. And so why it's so important to get a different peer group, to get a different group around you, because much like you, sometimes our family of origin may not be the most supportive to get us to the level through no fault of their own. But if you want to get to a certain level, you need a certain peer group. I always tell the story of, you know, it's not unusual that, and you're in an area where this is quite common with Colorado Springs, but a lot of, especially people I know that were veterans, would say, especially if they were in a high performance unit, Rangers, SEALs, recon, that that's the highest performance level of their life. And then when they get out, they never quite get that level of, I just was talking to somebody like that. He was on Air Force One as a communications NCO. And he goes, he always thought it was maybe he needed somebody yelling at him. And we were talking, I said, well, maybe it was the people you were with. They expected you to be excellent. It was not an option. You know, the president might walk by or the secretary of defense. That's a rather high bar when you're in the military. And so when you, and he goes, that's why I couldn't go back in the regular Air Force. And so, you know, when you surround yourself with those peers, then you begin to find what your peers' rituals are. So let's just, your turn to share, Mr. Stephen, on either one of those.
It's interesting because I would consider rituals actually, your proximity to the people around you to be considered part of a ritual. In my mind, the way I look at rituals, I'm actually going to be traveling to Montreal for NeuroOptimal here at the end of the month. And that was one of the things that I'm going to talk about is rituals. So I'm like you, I find them fascinating. First, you know, Tony has a ritual. He teaches a ritual called priming. You can go out on Facebook. You can search it through Facebook and Google and all that. I have a little different ritual. Like I said, I get up in the morning. I have a thing called the 7-step prayer. Dr. Will, you probably are well aware of that. And then I put that in my pocket. I make my commitment. Then I start my day. Another ritual that I have is when I go to work out, most people, when they go to the gym, they do reps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't do that. What I do when I'm in gym is I reload in my muscle. I load what's called a primary question. And my old primary question would be, you know, again, growing up in the world that I grew up in, it was, how will this fail? Where are the landmines? Who do I need to be, you know, who do I need to be concerned of? My head was always on a swivel. And so I was always looking for the other shoe to drop. Well, you know, when you have that kind of awareness and that's your primary question, that will lead you into some pretty interesting problems with your relationships with your significant other, your children, your friends, your family. And so I have a new primary question that I load when I'm at the gym, and it's, how can I experience and channel even more of God's abundant grace in my life now? That's one set, right? And so I'm not there so much to work this muscle, but to work this muscle in a very specific way. I believe we have three types of rituals. We have mental, physical, and spiritual rituals. And I believe that anything that you don't invest in won't flourish. If you don't finance something, you won't flourish it. And I'm not talking about just from a money perspective. I'm talking about from a time, from a focus, from the people you surround yourself with. You've got to make the investment in a way that you want the investment be to show up. It's always interesting to me that people want to be, you know, skinny, or they want to be wealthy, or they want to be. And I go in and I look at what rituals they have in their life, because we all have them, either conscious or unconscious. And I find out, well, their rituals are leading them. You're running east looking for a sunset. You're never going to find it. So I always go, okay, so let's look at our rituals. What are some of the physical rituals? Well, I do the gym 5 times a week. I read, and that also ties into a mental ritual. I have I get up in the morning, that physical anchor, right? I have those rituals. And then I have some mental rituals. I have some chants that I say, some things that I tell myself so that I can hear and prime my body and my mind the way I want to show up. And then, of course, we have spiritual rituals, those meditations, those prayers, those parts of ourselves that we try to connect to that higher version of ourselves. But I think the piece that I always want to stress when it comes with rituals is that ritual is anything you do consistently over a period of time. And as humans, we're ritualistic by nature, and we will create rituals one way or the other. It's whether or not we're committed to those rituals, whether or not those rituals are where we want to go, or whether or not those rituals will drive us. And part of that ritual is, who do I hang out with? Do I hang out with the people in my life that are going to make me step forward, step in, be a bigger, better, bolder version of self? Or do I hang out with those people that are going to give me reasons, excuses, validations, limitations that are going to hold me down to a lower quality of life for, you know, in multiple reasons for that? And so for me, it's always about taking that assessment of, okay, well, how am I showing up now? What are the rituals that I have in my life now? And are those driving me, pushing me in the direction that I want to show up? Are they making me the person that I truly want to be? Because if they're not, the question is why are you investing your resource, which is time, in that specific ritual?
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah. And you know what's what I always, since we know this, but a lot of people don't, and you don't know what you don't know. Our mind, as Maxwell Maltz brilliantly said, your mind doesn't know the difference between a real or a vividly imagined event. You know, if you're like, I'm a Star Wars fanatic. If you have a emotional response to a movie, we know it's not real, but your physical response is just as real as if it's happening to you. And so one of the things I like to think about is when I'm trying to get some new peer groups, some people to hang out with, if I can't get them up close and personal right now, I can create that peer group by reaching out, talking to them on the phone, maybe like we're doing here. And that, at least in my mind, that becomes my peer group. So, you know, what would Stephen think of this? What would, if it was going to be Tony Robbins or Deepak or whoever your peer group wants to be, they're going to hold you to a slightly different standard. And, you know, we can create that in our own minds. And that's something I think is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, there's a lot of research that's being done. I'm actually reading a book called Positive Psychology and Your Hero's Journey. It's a phenomenal book. If you have the opportunity to read it, pick it up. And they go into really researching why we feel what we feel, anger, sadness, joy. Like, what is the reason we as humans experience this emotional thing? And they've done a lot of research that ended up being very, very practical research on what is the ideal life? What is health? What does fulfillment look like? And what they suggest is, if you can't put yourself in proximity of people that you would want to be your peers, then if they've got books or literature, or if they've got stuff that you can digest, so that you can then put yourself, and like you said, Doc, you know, vividly imagine yourself in the room with these people interacting, because your mind and your body doesn't know the difference. Your mind will start to create those neurons as if that were your peer group. And so, you know, that's why I always recommend that you find those leaders in history that you would have, you know, if you could go back in time and you could have dinner with whoever you wanted, who would that be? Well, you know, Abraham Lincoln, I'd love to have dinner with that man and try to, you know, just pick his brain. And what was it like for you to travel down a road that sometimes might have felt really lonely, and knowing it was the right thing to do? Like, I would want to, I've got a series of questions I'd like to ask him. So go in and do the research, kind of study that man. And then you can say, you know, what would Abraham do? What would Abe do? You know, and then because you're rewiring those neurons, part of you will assume that that's your mentor and you'll step up.
Right. Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think one of our co-mentors, I guess you'd say, somebody we both look up to, Mr. Robbins, one of his mentors was Jim Rohn. And I heard Jim Rohn talk about, and a lot of motivational speakers say, you know, if I know the five people you hang out with the most and I know their income, I can average yours out pretty close. And that's been tested, and it's true. But I add, little things like, if you want to be in physical shape, if the five people you hang out with a lot are not in shape, it's a lot harder for you to be in shape. It's one of the reasons people that go to a gym have a tendency to be in better shape, because if nothing else, while you're there, even if it's just the casual, hey, how you doing? And also, too, we all know in the relationship world, if you're married or in a significant relationship and want to keep it, you probably need some friends that have some pretty good relationships. Because that gets you with it. You know, it's like, I know when I was doing one of my internships, for my psych license, one of the mentors would say, yep, first warning sign of a married couple is when one of the partners' best friend becomes single.
Yeah. Well, and then the other piece to that is that, you know, as humans, I was watching a TEDx show, a TEDx talk, and this guy was talking about addiction, and he went in and studied what had happened over in, I think it was not Peru, but, I can't remember. They went over, anyways, they legalized all drugs. And they said, these researchers had come in and they said, well, what do we, you know, the epidemic is like 20% of this country. Geez, where was it? I just did the homework on this. Anyways, so there was 20% of this country was addicted to heroin. And it's like, well, what are we going to do? And so they brought in these social scientists and they did all this research and they said, just legalize it. So just legalize it. So they said, yeah, legalize it. And they said, but before you go do that, you have to understand that all the money that you're using to fight addiction has to go in to supporting re-engaging them with society, re-engaging them with the community. Because, you know, in 1976, there was a research study done that really knocked off the war on drugs. They took this rat and they put this rat in a cage all by itself, and they fed it water with morphine in it. And what had happened was this rat, of course, got addicted to the morphine and then OD'd and died. And this documented research was the research that they used to really elevate the war on drugs and get us to where we are today. Well, there was another doctor who, Dr. Peterson, I want to say his name is, he came in and he looked at that research. He said, "Hi, I got a better idea." And what he did was he took these rats, instead of putting them all by themselves, he took these rats and he put them in what he called a rat park. And this rat park had, you know, whatever rat heaven would be, cheese and, you know, colored balls and, you know, your Ferris wheels where rats hang out. I don't know, there's a little rat bar where they all go hang out, shoot pool. I don't know. They called it rat park, right? And they put water in there and they put the water with the morphine. And what they found out was these rats that were in the rat park, none of them, not one OD from drinking water with morphine in it. And he thought, well, that's interesting. And then he did something even more interesting. And he took the rats and he put them in a cage by themselves and gave them a good month to get addicted to the morphine, and then pulled them out of that cage and put them in the rat park with the rest of the cool rats. And what he found out was those rats then would go back to a more healthy state. And again, zero ODs. And most of the rats would not use the water with morphine in it in any kind of negative way. I mean, this video, you can go out and research this. And so what we are as humans, we're societal. And so when I'm around, you know, I'm around four or five of my friends, and I've got, you know, my buddy here is, you know, shoplifting at Walmart, can't keep a needle out of his arm. And my buddy here is just, you know, all he wants to do is chase women and whatever. And my buddy here at all, he's just got anger problems. And I mean, you can pretty much look at my buddy list and go, okay, this is the kind of connection that he's looking to make. This is the kind of world he's going to create. You can see, you can almost predict with spooky accuracy how I'm going to end up. You take that same individual, pull them out of that world, and you put them in a world where they're hanging out with, you know, Dr. Horton, and they're hanging out with, you know, Tony, and that we start hanging out with these other people. We start reading these books. We start experiencing these different things. We start to open our mind up to something different and what's possible. And my belief is that if you take somebody out of a lower quality surrounding, and then you raise them into a higher quality surrounding, like putting them in the personal development world and surrounding them with people that are committed to being better, then what ends up happening is that person will then move to a more of a flourishing state.
Yeah, and what's cool with that, when people go to any one of my seminars, one of your seminars, a Tony seminar, and from people on the outside, they go, well, it's like a big cult. What are you going there for? It's the connection. You just said connection. Going with that happy rat, I call that the happy rat study. you know, in 1969, when Vietnam, and I'll self-disclose that never mind. But the all these, you know, like 25% of the troops in combat in Vietnam, first, they were very young. They were, if you want to use a diagnostic criteria, they were either substance abusers or substance dependent, heroin, morphine, alcohol, and pot. And hashish over there. So they were gearing up for this huge, huge epidemic of addictions. And what they found when the guys got back, most of them, you had a little bit of an adjustment period, and you always had about that 10% that kept into the addicted world badly that needed help. Most of the guys reacclimated quite well back into society. It goes with your happy rat. You were out of that cage of Vietnam, right? And then now you were back, and if you reconnected with your family and your friends, and even though the statistic, or, you know, diagnostically they were abusing the alcohol and drugs over there, they come back, and it went against like 50 years of what we would call recovery treatment dynamics, which made me, when I read the Happy Rat study and looked at the Vietnam studies, it made me open up my world on how I look at addictions, you know, and I've been in that world for 35 years.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. And then the other thing real quick, and I want your take on this, is there's that study of the twins. There were two boys raised by the father, right? You probably know this story. And yes. Father was alcoholic and a criminal and all that. I've heard it years ago. Anyway, the one, the father went to prison, and so they were split up, but they were both raised about the same. 20-year follow-up, the one boy's in prison, they're interviewing him, and they go, he goes, well, of course I ended up this way, given where I come from. They find the other boy. He's quite successful, happily married, productive member of society, as we'd say. And he would say, Of course I am. How could I not be, given the way I was raised? Same criteria. And I always say, you know, if you took a guy that was raised by an, you know, from a single family, one of the step parents that came, one of the fathers came in alcoholic, somewhat abusive. A lot of people say that's a recipe for failure. Well, I just described two of the last four presidents. Okay. You know, and they grow up and they, I would say, achieved quite well. Whether you like their politics or not is irrelevant.
Right. Yeah. To take a step back, the Vietnam data, it was 20% of Vietnam people. I actually have it here. Bruce Alexander's research is what we were. It's interesting that we're having this conversation. It's amazing because I literally just went down this road. So 20% of Vietnam people had an addiction to heroin. And when they came them back, it was like 95% of people dropped the addiction with no treatment, no 12-step, no nothing. And it was because they got put in the happy rat club, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you talk about that twin thing, what it reminds me of, you know, it reminds me of a what do they call them? The you go around the loops, get on the, my wife loves them. They're roller coasters. My wife loves roller coasters. And so when she gets on, she's very carefree. She's excited. You can see the look in her eyes. They're huge. You can feel the tension building up inside her. She's like, oh, my heart starts beating. And then it starts tick, 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 tick. And then I come down and then I whoop around and my body's out of control and I'm out of my body and I'm just whooped. I'm out of control. And then I come through and I'm stopped and my heart's racing and it's amazing. You put me on a roller coaster and it's going to be, my eyes are going to be great big. My heart's going to start racing and tick, 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 tick. And I'm going to think, oh man, my head, my body's going to be out of my body. I'm going to loop around. I'm going to have any control. Same exact experience, two completely different reactions out of them. And as you were talking, I thought, well, what is the difference? And I think the difference here is that radical ownership of the outcome. So you go to the guy who, you know, in and out of prison, you know, grew up in this childhood, you know, it was nothing but problems. And you say, well, why did you end up this way? Well, I'm such a victim. I mean, look, I mean, I didn't have any other choice. I'm just a product of my environment. And you go to the other guy and you go, well, you know, you're a successful twin. Like, how did you get here? And he goes, well, what did you expect? I saw this and I was going to not have that. I think it's that radical ownership. It's about, well, what am I going to do differently? And when I look at where I showed up, that really is what it tied into. I asked myself, what am I going to do here? And I started to research and started to reach out. And then I learned to get off the cross because we needed the wood. Right?
Yeah. 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 And I don't like, I don't need holes in my hands, so I'll just come down off that platform.
I need my hands to type with, so that's not going to work for me, right? And so and that's really what it's about is like, okay, so then once I take ownership, and that can go bleed into any area of my life, I can look at, okay, where do I feel out of control? Where do I feel powerless? And really, when you look at any kind of suffering, all suffering comes from, you know, less loss, never. It comes from focusing on the self. It comes from feeling out of control and feeling as though you're being pulled in 50 different directions. But when I say, hang on a minute, this is my responsibility. I've got to do something to change it. Then what happens is I take all that back. I then start to come in a world where now I get to make a decision on which direction I want to go. And I get to show up in a different way that way. I don't get to do that when I say, well, what did you expect? My family was a bunch of drug addicts and da, 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 da. And I went down that road. I tried that and that didn't work. I thought, well, if you can't be a good example, be a bad excuse. Like, you know, if you're going to be an outlaw, be the biggest, baddest outlaw you could be. And that didn't work for me either. It was just more suffering and more pain and more heartache. It wasn't until I took ownership and said, okay, who do I really want to be as a man and how do I really want to show up? And I started reaching for tools that would help me reach that plateau that I was actually able to really get any traction underneath me. Otherwise, in my humble opinion, that guy that, what else, he doesn't even know that he's the reason he's stuck. He has no clue because in his mind, he's got a perfectly good excuse. And that for me is the danger zone. When I've got a perfectly good excuse for failure, I know I'm in a bad spot. I need to find a better spot as quickly as possible.
Right. I know one of the things changed my life when I ran into a group of people who said, "We'll judge you by your actions, not your intentions."
Exactly.
And
exactly.
And then it's like, damn, I always had great intentions. My actions were horrible.
They call that, what are they? There's a name for it. It's the error. When I do something wrong, it's because of the situation. If you do something wrong, it's because you're a mean SOB. You just suck at life, right? And we have this belief system that says, well, my intentions are always good. So it's like, you know, growing up, I watched reading comic books. I was a big Star Wars fan myself. It's one of the reasons why I love your content. And the metaphors, the Star Wars metaphors that you throw in. But, you know, I always thought, well, there's a real clear view of evil. But of course, then as the story evolves, we start to see, well, it wasn't as clear of a view as you quite thought it was. Right. And that's a little more, you know, that's been my awareness in life is that, you know, every evil person that you go to, in their mind, they're not evil. In their mind, they're the good guy. And it's becoming aware. So then I got to look at, okay, if I think I'm the good guy here and I wrong somebody and they think I'm the bad guy, for me, what I've done is I've learned that one of the triggers that gets loaded, as soon as I hit that, a flare goes up in the air and says, okay, well, how are you showing up in a way that isn't the way you want to show? Whether you're right or wrong or indifferent, how could you be totally blind? Because like you said, it's not what you don't know. And here's the thing, it's you don't know what you don't know, but it's not what you don't know, it's what you don't know that you don't know. And so it's like, well, I've got to at least know so then I can make a decision. I can't make a decision because then I react unconsciously if I don't know. So I always look at it, try to see it from the other person's eyes so that I can get a better perspective. Because typically, you know, the stuff that I think, if you followed around the mass hysteria that's in this brain, like we wouldn't be talking right now. They'd have me locked up in a corner. So,
yeah. Hey, how can people get in touch with you, Mr. Steven?
They can get in touch with me. I've got a Facebook page. So Steven.Tuig, that's Tuohig. I have a website, strategy.zone, but that's still in the building stages. But you can get me on Facebook, Steven Tuig. You can get me there. I've got a bunch of content up on there. I'm up on Twitter. Not as much on Twitter, but most of the time you can find me on Facebook for sure.
Right. And, you know, it's funny you should say that. We'll wrap it up. There was a cool thing I read somewhere, probably Facebook or someplace, where the idea that every person you meet has a different image of you. And we don't even realize that. You know, the guys from the health club, just today I was talking to them about something. When they found out what I did for a living, they're like, really? And I'm like, well, yeah, I assume they know it. They said, no, we see you coming in every day with your cowboy hat. You got your boots on because I come back from taking care of the horse. They just thought I probably had a ranch, you know. And so I'm like, wow, the power of we're always presenting and getting feedback. And so our mind hack today as we wrap up is to, as Stephen brilliantly said, create this mastermind group in your mind. And you're not limited necessarily by time or space. And all the people I know, the Tony Robbins, the Deepak Chopras, not that I know them personally, that you know what I mean, but they're always sharing their information. The one thing I do know about Mr. Robbins, he doesn't hold anything back. If you get him, he'll answer whatever question you have. He'll tell you, maybe you don't want to hear what he's going to say, you know, or all these people there, or me, you, it's like, you know, use the people that are out there. And as you said, read. Always be. I'm going to order a book today on habits, a different book on habits. I'm going to start studying that again. So that's the mind hack. Create that group and just close your mind and imagine having conversations with these people. And so
that's powerful.
I'd like to thank you for being on this today's interview, and we'll hand it back off to our illustrious producer, Mr. Chris. So thank you all for joining. Please click like and share. If you watch this and you liked it, click like and share and write a comment. We love that to let us know, and have a great day.
You've been listening and watching No Limit People with Dr. Will Horton here on Facebook Live and RadioBuzz.com. Join us each week at 12 p.m.